Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another edition of Your Health Today with Good Samaritan Hospital. We're joined once again by Karen Kanzler, who is a community outreach nurse at Good Sam, and she runs a program called Red Hot Mamas. Now, are we talking about a hospital here?
Yes, we are, Mark. Red Hot Mamas is great fun. We're in actually our third year now, and it is a series of very lively, ongoing seminars that talk about everything you ever wanted to know about menopause. Women come there, they get answers, they find resources to solve their problems, and it's great fellowship or sisterhood, I should say.
So when did this start?
About 3 years ago.
So what kind of things do you cover?
We cover any kind of problems that may come across during this special time, and we put it in a really lighter form. Sexual dysfunction, sleeping disorders, mood swings, hormones, and the ever-dreaded urinary incontinence.
So what you just described doesn't sound light to me. And they sound like things happen to people and they can be pretty traumatic, no?
It could be traumatic, but a lot of it is how you handle it. Attitude is everything. And there's all kinds of resources and solutions for all of these things that irritate your life during this time. So, there's help out there, and Red Hot Mamas is a great solution.
So, do women come for a long time to these groups?
We have women that come every single month since the inception of this program.
Because menopause can last a month or it can last 2 years.
Oh, it can last longer.
Longer, even.
There's no set rules in menopause. Start, duration, or finish. It's all individual.
So this is a group that really just helps women work through the medical issues that they may face in menopause, but in a way that just makes it part of life as opposed to some medical disorder.
Right, and you get a lot of help knowing that in the same room there's, tons of people that are going through what you are and that are very willing to talk about it.
So what were the last few sessions about that you did?
The last few sessions have been about your breast health, of course, in October. We also always touch upon hormones, but the one we have coming up is really great.
Which is what?
It's about urinary incontinence. It has a really cute title. It's called Hold Everything, Your Urinary Health, and it will be on Thursday, December 3rd at 6 p.m. at Good Samaritan Hospital.
I was laughing because I love the names you come up with.
I do, too.
Hold everything.
I do, too.
So tell me about the urinary incontinence and what will happen at these sessions. What kind of things will you be covering?
Well, it's very prevalent. About 25 million American adults suffer from urinary incontinence.
Men and women?
Men and women, mm-hmm. Yes. And certainly men are not excluded. And there are it's often very treatable. It certainly can be treated through things like physical therapy, doing your Kegels on a regular basis, but very disciplined Kegel exercises.
Kegel exercises?
Yes, K-E-G-E-L. They're your Kegel exercises. That's where you squeeze everything from the waist down.
Gotcha. Okay.
Different behavior modification exercises, kind of like biofeedback type things. And in more severe cases, there'll be surgical interventions to help the different types of incontinence.
So when's the program?
Thursday, December 3rd at 6 p.m. at Good Samaritan Hospital.
And this is open to anyone who's dealing with issues of menopause.
Sure.
Be part of this Red Hot Mamas.
Correct.
They can call 443-444-4100 or visit goodsam-md.org and take part in Red Hot Mamas. Good Samaritan Hospital, proud member, MedStar Health. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are going to spend the next hour looking at what the latest is with Mayor Shieldickson's trial, and again, some of the political social implications of what we heard and are hearing. Joining me in studio, of course, this is Monday, so Anthony McCarthy, host of the Anthony McCarthy Show, heard here every Friday afternoon from 5 to 7 p.m., is in the studio as co-hosting. Anthony?
Great to see you, Mark.
Always. We're joined for the first time by Cheryl Wood, who's a criminal defense attorney and owner of the Wood Law Firm, former state and federal prosecutor. Cheryl, nice to meet you.
Welcome. Nice to see you, Mark.
Also in the studio is somebody who's no stranger to our show, Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law.
Nice
Thanks
to
for coming
see you
again,
again,
Doug. And on the phone, we have Sherilyn Eiffel, civil rights attorney, author and professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law as well. Sherilyn, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Hi, Sherilyn.
And also, as usual, every day we talk about the trial. Melody Simmons is on the phone, who was covering the trial for both WEAA and the Center for Emerging Media that produces my show and Anthony's show, and also doing writing for Baltimore Brew online.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, Melody. Welcome. So, very quickly, Melody, tell us what transpired today.
Well, about a half hour ago, a note came forth from the jury. They've been deliberating all day. And the note said, we're making progress, but we would like to go home. So this mirrors an earlier note on Friday. And so the judge has released them for the day. They're to report back and begin deliberations again at 9 a.m. It's going very slowly. There have been a lot of notes coming out of the jury room today, mostly just reporting, you know, a little bit of fatigue, a little bit of overheated discussions, you know, asking for certain meanings to certain legal terms. So there's a lot of good questions. And Arnold Weiner, Mayor Dixon's, one of her defense attorneys came out of the courtroom just a few minutes ago and basically said that he was pleased that the jury's taking its time and it shows that they're being very meticulous.
And I'm curious to get all of our legal partners here, their analysis of what they think is happening so far. Sherilyn?
Well, I agree that I think it's a good thing that the jury is taking careful time to deliberate. They sent out a note today, if I'm not mistaken, Melody, asking about one of the exhibits and whether the exhibit was still validly included in the materials that they should be reviewing. So
that's
it's
correct.
Clear that, yeah, this is not going to be a knee-jerk reaction. They're trying to be careful. They are, I'm sure, well aware that this verdict, whatever it is, will be subjected to a tremendous amount of scrutiny. And it sounds like they're doing what we want juries to do.
And this is why we have so much faith in the jury system, because ordinary people take their responsibility seriously. When we talk about the jury being the conscience of the community, and we're watching democracy in action here. We're watching 12 people coming from 12 different places and sharing ideas. And what's encouraging today is that they're working, and they're working very hard. They're sharing information. They're asking questions. We're not getting notes, or at least I'm not aware of any notes, in which the jurors are saying, aside from fatigue, they're not saying, we got to get out of here. The things are getting a little too wild in here. Instead, what they're saying is, we're making progress, and that was the second note today where they said that, and that's encouraging because it looks as though they're going to be able to reach at least some verdicts in this case.
Well, there have been some notes that said that the room is overheated. I mean, and that does not refer to the temperature. That refers to the fact that they are debating, and they are debating in a very spirited way. And so there was some concern last week about that. But they seem to be working through it. They seem to be working together, and it appears to be, you know, towards some kind of verdict. Who knows when it's going to come down?
Sherwood?
Yeah, I think there will be a verdict at some point, but the question becomes, in this case, is it easier, the fact that they're grappling, what does that mean for the mayor? And I think, is it easier to acquit, given that it's such a small monetary amount, that the victims aren't specified by name? Is that something they could do easier? But if conviction, I mean, that's tremendous. It's going to have a tremendous effect on the city. You know, the loss of an elected mayor, loss of her pension, an historic mayor, the first African-American female mayor. So I think they are really grappling. If it was an acquittal, a quick acquittal, that would be one thing. But they're really grappling, I think, with the possibility of conviction.
I agree. I think they realize the gravity of their decisions and their deliberations. This jury is taking it very seriously. And I do think that they realize that, you know, they could rock the city.
Sherilyn, you and I have talked about this on the phone a few times over the last week. And I'd like you to just, if you could kind of summarize a bit of your analysis of where you see this trial, both in its kind of political and social implications.
Well, there's so much here. I mean, I can maybe hit on a point or two. You know, it's an important moment for the city. This is one of those moments, I think, in which we're really seeing that, you know, the future of our city is something that's very much often, you know, on the minds of the residents of the city, including jurors. And almost from the very beginning, this whole action involving Mayor Dixon has been cast in that light. And I don't think it's been cast in that light merely by those who support the mayor. You know, there's always been this question about what's at stake, and it's clear that what's at stake is more than the political reputation of the mayor, the political future of the mayor, the state prosecutor. You know, it's been always very clear that this is something larger. And so although there are many implications that have to do with race and gender and so forth, I think the biggest one is that it would be nice to pretend that this is just about, you know, an incident of gift cards and whether or not they were used properly. But everyone knows that this is about where are we headed as a city. You know, I have to say it's an ironic situation to be in. You know, I said jokingly the other day that, you know, we finally have a mayor of Baltimore City whose ambition is to be mayor of Baltimore City. And I think that people recognize that, and that makes it difficult, you know, as was just suggested by Cheryl Woods and by Melody, that, you know, you realize what conviction could mean. At the same time, you know, this is an important trust that the jury has. We all, you know, feel that corruption should be dealt with if there is corruption. And so you want to make sure that you do the right thing. And even though the jurors are supposed to keep all that out of their minds when they're in the deliberations, there's no way that that's not part of the concern. And so long as there are 12 jurors from Baltimore City, a jury of mm-hmm. the mayor's peers, those jurors have to be thinking about the future of this very, very troubled city, have to be thinking about, you know, what this means for the future of that city, and have to be laboring mightily to put those considerations aside and decide this case based on the evidence that's been presented in the courtroom.
Mark, three of our four guests have been in the courtroom, have been following. I want to get all of you, your take on the atmosphere. I think a lot of people are sitting at home and they have a perception of what's going on in the courtroom while a verdict is being, I guess, essentially waited for, and that the mayor is there. There are all these questions about her running the city, who's running the city while she sits there and waits for a verdict. If we could just go around, Cheryl, starting with you, what's the atmosphere as you've been in there, you've been watching? What's happening in that courtroom as we wait for this historic verdict?
Yeah, I think everyone is very, you know, on pins and needles, really waiting and really watching the mayor. And she is composed. She is visiting with staff. She is visiting with her lawyers and, you know, carrying forth the business of the city as best she can. She did go to City Hall this morning and come back. So she's trying to do that. There are individuals in the courtroom who have many of the concerns that individuals who call into the show have. They're looking at some of the red herrings, like, well, who dropped off the gift cards at Mayor Dixon's office? And wouldn't that person have to complain about this? Well, if someone gives me something, I'm allowed to use it. So what's the problem here? And why was all this money spent on this investigation? These are the types of comments that you hear in the courtroom. And many of the people in the courtroom are supporters of the mayor. But there are also individuals who do not know the mayor, but just want to be there. Some that are praying for her. I met a pastor today that's there, not really knowing her, but praying for her. So there's really a lot of support for her in the courtroom and people sitting there day after day. And there's quite a number of people. The courtroom's never empty.
Doug?
And I would certainly agree with that, starting from the closing argument where the courtroom became not only packed, but there was standing room only. But I was sort of surprised for the first few days of the trial because it was a much more subdued atmosphere. The courtroom was not filled, and testimony witnesses were being called, and they were testifying for some period. They'd be dismissed. There wasn't a great reaction. I mean, you'd see some of the same people, but this could have been almost an ordinary trial for some of the days. As we started getting with more of the drama, when the prosecutor decided not to call the main developer here, Mr. Lipscomb, then things started to really pick up at that point, because all of a sudden, instead of looking at a 2 or 3 week trial, we were now going to close testimony after 6 days. So from that point on, but Sherilyn's right about one very important point that she's making. Throughout every day, every time the jury comes out, you can see just how much they're paying attention. When Sherilyn refers to the fact that they're laboring mightily, it's not only during deliberation. This was the kind of a jury that most lawyers would want to have deciding a case.
Melody, quick thought?
I think that there's a lot of tension in the courtroom. I sense that today. I also sense that there's a great amount of focus. And the focus is on the jury and the mayor. And, of course, the mayor as Cheryl said, is very composed. I think at times today she was very subdued. She is surrounded by aides and surrounded by friends. And so there's a lot of support for her. There's also a great amount of, I don't want to say boredom, but it's very difficult to wait all day for many, many hours on end. It's almost like being in a hospital waiting room while someone you love is in surgery.
Let me get everybody to join us here at 410-319-8888 as we take a look at what's happening today and what the potential is for, with the outcome of Sheila Dixon's trial. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Melody Simmons, covering the trial for us, joins us every day she's here. Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law. Sheila Neifel, also professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law. Cheryl Wood, criminal defense attorney and owner of the Wood Law Firm. And, of course, Anthony McCarthy, co-host here on Mondays, 410-319-8888. Sheldon writes in an interesting question. Sheldon says, in regards to the Sheila Dixon case, I'm not sure anyone has commented that the Office of the State Prosecutor has a very long history of losing public corruption cases. When, not if, Dixon is acquitted... That's interesting. Hers will be the latest in a long line of state public corruption cases that begin with a lot of sound and fury and ultimately end seemingly signifying nothing. Whether it's Warbauer or his longtime predecessor, Stephen Montanarelli, the state prosecutor is severely under-resourced and therefore unable to handle white-collar criminal cases, which are always very confusing and easy generators of reasonable doubt. The political secret behind the state prosecutor's office is that it was designed to fail. By concentrating public corruption cases in one office and then severely underfunding the office, legislators have given themselves a get-out-of-jail-free card should they find themselves facing a public corruption case. It is time to abolish the office and turn it over to the Attorney General. As constitutional officer with far greater resources, the AG would have a much better ability to deal with these cases than does the state prosecutor. Sherilyn, let me let you go first.
Well, I'm not as familiar with the long history as others might be, but it's not my understanding that a lack of resources was the problem in this case. And I think that one of the postmortems of this case is going to be a real examination of some of the decisions made in this case. I think I mentioned this before when I was on Anthony's show. You know, prosecutors have what is called discretion. They make decisions all the time about what cases to bring and what cases not to bring. And they base that decision not just on the guilt or innocence of the suspect, but based on the resources that would be needed to try the case, based on the likelihood of obtaining a conviction, based on the level of charges they'd be able to bring, and so forth. And I think that in this case, where there is not evidence that there was a lack of resources, this is the result of a 4-year investigation by the state prosecutor. I think the more pressing questions are going to be around the decision to bring this case once the 4-year investigation had yielded the charges of lack of disclosure and the using of the gift card. That if he couldn't tie it to the quid pro quo, whether this was the best case to bring. And I think that's actually going to be the focus of our attention once the jury issues its decision. Whether they convict or not, I think that examination is still going to be very much on the table.
I want to pick that up. Let the other guests chime in on that, and then we'll all jump into this. Doug?
Well, I certainly think that in this trial, the prosecutor has been doing a very good job. I mean, we can always be critical of tactical decisions, but this has been a very solid prosecution presentation. There were mistakes made, discovery mistakes and all, but in terms of how this case is actually playing out in front of people who are in the courtroom, and after hearing the prosecution's closing argument, you have to come away saying that a conviction certainly is possible here. This is not a white-collar crime, by the way. This is the crime of theft itself. The crime of appropriating property is something that a lot of people are in jail for today who have been charged with much less than $1,500 or $1,000 worth of property. I mean, our clients in the Maryland Law School Clinic, we represent people who are charged with $5, $10, $50 thefts, and they stay in jail. They don't get just released. They stay in jail for 30 days and longer. So I would like to share Sherilyn's point of view that if we're going to ask whether this was the best case to bring, we also ought to ask whether the cases that the police and prosecutors are bringing against ordinary people, working people, poor people, makes the best use of our resources too.
Yeah, I think that goes to the point of the state prosecutor during his rebuttal closing. Mm-hmm. And he said equal justice. He talked about, you know, the fact that, you know, Lindbergh Carpenter, for example, who was charged with misappropriating or stealing seven of the Holly Trolley gift cards and pled guilty and resigned from his job. And so, you know, the question becomes, there are questions about the state prosecutor's office, about selective prosecution, of why they chose to bring this particular case. But as far as funds, going back to the original comment, I mean, they used a jury consultant, which is something that, you know, is not usually done. So clearly they had resources. They were able to use the jury consultant. They were able to put together a team of five or six, if not more, and I'm sure there were others working on it, the investigators, et cetera. So it was a case that they put together. They decided to bring it. Does the action that they're alleging fits within the statute? And so, yes, after this, it certainly would be appropriate to have a conversation about that office and whether it's political and what its purpose originally was and whether it's fulfilling that purpose.
Anthony, hasn't this
happened? Yeah, I was going to say before the last round of comments was about the court of public opinion that we keep talking about. And on this show, on my show and on Mark's show, we get tons of calls from people who are essentially saying, look, such a little amount of money after such a long investigation and an investment of so much money. I think all of you have really answered that question well about whether or not this prosecutor had the discretion, given the evidence, to bring this to trial. I do want to ask, however, about something specific that happened today for our listeners who are going to follow this, following the news. Melody and Cheryl were there, about the question from the jury about Exhibit 3, I think it was, and a very specific list from one of the mayor's staffers that outlined families who are in need from 2006, the Holly Trolley Tour of 2006, whether it was still in their purview to consider that as they're making their decision. And obviously the judge said, yes, it is, but the timing seems to be off on whether or not that evidence should have been included on the list by the attorneys and the prosecutor to strike from the consideration of this jury. Cheryl, what's your first thoughts on that?
I think it shows that the jury is really, you know, they're kind of wading their way through this, and they're understanding that, wait a minute, this was from 2006, Holly Trolley. That's not what's charged. 2007 is charged. And I think, well, they thought, well, let's go ask because this does not seem relevant. And they have figured it out. What somehow the lawyers on both sides did not include that on the list. It's not the judge's role. The judge asked the lawyers to identify those exhibits that would no longer be relevant, considering that Lipscomb didn't testify. But my question is, I don't know why it was relevant in the first place, because it's really not related to Lipscomb. It's related to Holly Trolley. So I guess somehow what happened in 2006 is relevant to what happened in 2007, and they're supposed to consider it. So we're, you know, it's considered, whatever they put that evidence in, whatever the purpose of it was, it's to be considered along with the Holly Trolley. But this goes to my point, and I made a few days ago, is that the jury, I think, is really focused on the Holly Trolley. I mean, that's, you know, almost a more difficult issue, you know, in that she had five gift cards in her house and gave one $15 one to an employee. What do you do with that? And they asked lots of questions about that. What is misappropriation? How long is it before it's theft? I mean, it seemed like they're really still focused. And think about this. If the verdict sheet is any indication, if they went in order, then they've already dealt with the Turner counts. And now they're dealing with Holly Trolley. And they dealt with those Turner counts, if we go with this theory, in the first couple of hours. Because misappropriation, they started asking questions about that a few hours after they went into deliberation.
I think also, Anthony, I think that Lindbergh Carpenter's testimony really painted a picture of a lot of gift cards at City Hall with no system in which mm-hmm. to disseminate them. So a question like that says to me that they're wondering, is there a system, despite what Mr. Carpenter testified to, is there a system, are there a list of families that need these certain gift cards? And I think, as Cheryl said, you know, they're really peeling the onion back. I mean, they're going layer by layer looking at all the testimony, and that this might be an indication of where they're at right now.
This is where, and I'm going to get a public into here, 410-319-8888. It says, trial seems to be winding down, but we won't know until it actually winds down and concludes, and the jury comes back with its verdict. And a number of issues have been brought up here today about the decision to bring this case in the first place, as Sherilyn brought up, because it doesn't seem to be tied, at least we haven't seen yet being tied, to quid pro quo.
But why does it have to be?
Yeah, I'm curious about that.
And the race and gender aspects.
It has to be because it's the result of a four-year investigation that costs us a lot of money. That's the reason. I'm not saying that, you know, it doesn't change the fact that illegality is illegality. No question about it. But the question that I think people have to be asking when we're, if we're talking about resources, because what we're, you know, we're talking about the question that just came to us was about the state prosecutor's office and whether they've got resources. The original charges that were being investigated about the mayor's sister, Janice Dixon, and jobs and so forth, those struck me as very important, critical questions. And there may be in this as well. I mean, having not tightened up the fit on the quid pro quo, I've got a lot of questions about these developers dropping off gift cards and envelopes with no names. I mean, it all sounds quite distressing to me. But having not been able to tie that together and instead advancing with the claim of a couple thousand dollars, and not even putting on what was supposed to be the star witness, which is that, you know, the mayor has this personal relationship with the developer. We all care about our city. We don't want to believe our city's been turned over to developers for improper purposes. But that's not the stuff that got charged. And so I do think it's a legitimate question.
For
the same reasons that Doug says, we ought to be asking about the prosecutor's decision to charge people for stealing $5 and $10 as well.
So we're going to hold that thought. And, Doug, you can leap right back into the fray as soon as we return from this break, because this is a question we've been talking about all week long, and I'm glad that you all are here to kind of wrestle with this, because I think this is at the heart of the public discussion of what this trial means. 410-319-8888. You can join this as well. We'll be right back. First, Melody, I know you have to run. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Melody Simmons, who will be reporting on this trial until the trial is done. And we're going to take a very brief break and come back. Urbanite Radio Stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by National Connections Academy, an accredited online private school with affordable tuition for grades K through 12. Visit nationalconnectionsacademy.com for more information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here with Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, Cheryl Wood, criminal defense attorney and owner of Wood Law Firm, Sherilyn Ifill, civil rights attorney, noted author and professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, 410-319-8888 for you all to jump in on this discussion at this very critical juncture in our discussion, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Doug, go ahead.
Well, I mean, Sherilyn makes a very good point that the investigation begins from the idea that there's this relationship between developers and people in public office, and perhaps there are bribes that are taking place, perhaps there's illegalities. As a prosecutor investigates, what the prosecutor alleges is a different crime, but it's connected to the others. It's connected to the relationship between an elected official and people who depend on government contracts to earn their millions of dollars. So it may be that this trial leads to something else. But what's difficult to understand is if it's true that a public official was taking money that was intended for the poor, for the needy, for children, and if that public official was using it for her own purposes unlawfully, it's difficult to understand why people wouldn't regard that as a serious offense. Now, people can disagree. They can say this is politically motivated. There's lots of other things going into it. But that crime by itself, considering how many years I've witnessed this criminal justice system of ours prosecute people, this is not an unusual crime. I mean, the crime of theft over $500 is not an unusual crime.
Cheryl?
It isn't. I think that I think that prosecutors take their investigation wherever it goes. And this one happened to go towards these charges. Now, I think Sherilyn's right. We really have that question hanging out there. What happened with the original purpose of the investigation? Some of the pleas that happened during the course of the investigation of Dale Clark and Mildred Boyer, what happened? And maybe these prosecutors should do some type of report at some point to wrap it up and kind of explain where they went in their investigation. And prosecutors don't like to do that. They like to leave the door open. But maybe that's appropriate to kind of explain. But the investigation, I'm thinking about Whitewater and where that went and where it ended up and all the angles that it took. And prosecutors, when this sort of thing comes out, and the Helen Holton charges, for example, when they come out of their investigation, even though that wasn't the original purpose, and they feel like, you know, here's a case, here it is, we can prove this case, we're going to bring it, that's what they did.
But it feels like, and I think that, I'm so glad you mentioned Whitewater, because it does give us that feeling. And I had mentioned the other day the trial of Mike Espy, the former agriculture secretary, who was tried and acquitted of charges that he had provided favors to Tyson Foods in exchange for football tickets. You know, the problem is that when a prosecutor gets knee-deep in, years into an investigation in which the public has big expectations and in which perhaps the prosecutors even encourage the idea that there's, you know, that there's big fish at the end of the hook, it may be hard politically for the prosecutor of whatever political party affiliation to simply say, you know, we've got nothing. And I think, you know, I think, Cheryl, actually that's a great idea to provide some kind of report. I think the bad taste that's left is that you bring charges that and end up feeling more like a case being tried in the court of public opinion as a kind of political case. Because what we're left with right now, the prosecutor having not tied the ends up, in fact, having decided not even to put Lipscomb on, who was supposed to, you know, tell us how Mayor Dixon knew that, you know, these votes were coming up, and so at least that's what we originally thought. You know, at some point then it leaves a kind of a feeling out there in the public that we're supposed to just kind of wink, wink, nod, nod, get what was going on, but nothing's actually been proven. And I think this is actually deeply corrosive of confidence in the criminal justice system.
Bringing this kind of case?
That public confidence in the criminal justice system is deeply eroded, as it was with Whitewater. People are not walking around thinking that Ken Starr was a profile in courage for what ultimately resulted. It ended up feeling like a witch hunt. It ended up feeling like a politically motivated investigation. The beginning of it, whether there was in fact corruption that had happened in some of the dealings of Mrs. Clinton at that point, you know, that started out as something serious. What it ended up as was something serious in that it had ended up with the president lying under oath about someone he had an affair with. But there, I think there are very few people who, if they speak candidly, think it was worth it in terms of the millions upon millions of dollars that was spent and the distraction in public resources and time that was spent to, you know, nail the president for lying about having an affair.
Let me ask you three of this question. Unless you have a response you want to make very quickly, 410-319-8888. We'd like to get your thoughts on what you're hearing our guests, Cheryl Wood, Doug Colbert, and Cheryl and I will wrestle with here when it comes with regards to the Mayor Dixon's case. Pending before the court now, waiting for Jordy to come back. Of course, Anthony McCarthy co-hosting with me as we kind of probe this one more day. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I mean, is part of it maybe, and that maybe this is not a fair question to ask three attorneys, but but you all also are thinkers about our social condition. You're not just attorneys. And Anthony's a deep thinker about our social conditions. Is part of it is that some of these things become politically motivated in terms of who hires a prosecutor, A. B, that because of the way politics works in America, or politics works at the local level in Baltimore or Maryland, that it's difficult to prove any legal wrongdoing between inside the power centers. That people are close. The biggest, wealthiest developers are close to the people who are in political power and run the political parties. In this state, it's the Democratic Party. And that relationship is just too difficult to get in when it comes to trying to find a legal case against a politician because they're doing things in a legal manner. And what happened maybe to Sheila Dixon is she didn't play the game right, took some tickets she shouldn't have taken instead of playing the game as smartly as her predecessors played the game. That maybe we're looking at that, and this issue of corruption we'll never get to this way because you might not be able to get to it in a purely legal fashion. Maybe it has to be unearthed in some other ways. Let me posit that to my guests.
Well, I would only answer it by saying two words, and that would be Rod Blagojevich. You know, Patrick Fitzgerald was quite successful. we haven't had a trial yet, but, you know, I'm not sure that I agree that it's never possible, and there are a few towns that are more politically clubby than Chicago. And yet, you know, the ability of U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald to get Blagojevich on something that everyone would agree is really important, you know, the selling of a Senate seat.
But
and to build a case that the public can recognize as being an important case. We don't know what would happen at trial and whether Mr. Blagojevich would be deemed to be guilty. But that's a real case. That's a corruption case investigated by the U.S. attorney carefully, presented by the U.S. attorney to the public, with a public offering of some of the proof that will be offered at trial. Certainly Mr. Blagojevich has an opportunity to defend himself, but I don't think there's anybody who thinks that was a waste of resources. That looks like a use of resources that actually promotes the public trust.
But the difference between that and what's going on here, and I'm at the right here, is that you know, when you had Tommy Bromwell, there was a phone call just like Blagojevich. There were tapes of calls where there were obviously something very illegal going on.
Yeah, those wiretaps will really help you. And I agree. I agree with Sherilyn. I mean, that was, you know, they had the wiretaps for months. They had cooperators, and they made a case that everyone can agree is important and is relevant. Mark, you were saying, well, you know, did the mayor here, did she play the game as smart as some of her predecessors? And some of us agree, you know, that this is not probably anything new. If the charges are true, you know, it's probably not anything new. We know that things pass back and forth. I don't know how people feel about it, but, you know, that happens. I think here, this goes to the point of this case and the developers and the relationship with the mayor. And I know that we didn't have the biggest relationship, and the prosecutors did come out that we have this big bang, and there was no big bang with the Lipscomb. But Turner, when you think about him, I mean, he's clearly friends with the mayor. His wife is friends with the mayor, and he was very reluctant. And I thought his demeanor really showed that he really didn't want, you know, there are other friendships here and there is a closeness, and there that he really didn't want to testify against the mayor, but he had to. And so he said as little as he could. You know, I don't know if he really does remember what they talked about when he had a conversation with her right before he bought the cards and right after. But he says he doesn't remember. He doesn't remember who dropped them off, but they were dropped off. I mean, but he had to remember that they were bought because they were. He had to remember that admit there were phone calls because there were phone records, and she spent them. So I think, you know, if his testimony is to be believed and there's nothing in the record, you know, to really challenge his credibility, then what do you do with that? If you did, in fact, ask him to buy the gift cards and then they show up, even if they're unmarked, and you told him which stores to go to, which is what he said, and they show up at your office, wouldn't you think they were from him?
So we know that there are politically motivated prosecutions, and Sherilyn has named quite a few of them. We know that there are race motivated prosecutions. And so the idea that, could this be another politically race-motivated prosecution? Possible. I'd like to have some little bit more facts before I reach that conclusion, because what Cheryl and I are seeing in the courtroom is a prosecution case against someone who allegedly took property belonging to others. And Cheryl's point is...
Cheryl
Wood, the attorney here... What are you supposed to do with this information? If you go in an investigation and you learn that there are gift cards that a developer, actually three developers actually said that they all went out and they bought these gift cards that they were intended for the poor, and somehow the mayor claims that she had every right to use them, that there were no limitations. But from a prosecutor point of view, these are gift cards that were meant for others that wound up with the mayor. And then you have a housing authority which has a program only for the needy. And Toys R Us gifts are supposed to wind up for kids. They wind up with an elected official. So what are you supposed to do with that? Is that we can talk about it, and maybe people feel, hey, we should not be prosecuting a public official, a mayor who's only charged with taking $1,000 or $1,500. Maybe there should be some exception for public officials. But I guess I would at least like to know that there is a political motivation and a race motivation, or a motivation against the first black woman mayor of the city, before I'm going to inject this into the conversation. Because I haven't seen enough for me to say that this is another one of Mike Espy type prosecutions.
But here's the thing though, Doug. I think it's not fair to suggest that you have to make the leap that it's racially motivated or politically motivated to suggest that this prosecution, the decision to bring these charges, is questionable. What I was saying earlier on, and that's part of why I was bringing up what happens to prosecutors when they get knee-deep in, regardless of their political affiliation, regardless of the race of the target. My point was about what I think is corrosive of public confidence in the criminal justice system. And the examples that I gave, the Whitewater example, as contrasted with the Blagojevich example, which, by the way, both involve defendants from the same political party, was that the public can feel it when the investigation and the charges line up to something that really matters to them. And every time you take the chance of opening the kind of can that the state prosecutor has in this case, without being able to bring to bear all of the pieces that make the public feel that their resources have been validly used, you further undermine what is already the shaky public confidence in the criminal justice system. And that's all I'm saying is, you know, not that these charges are irrelevant, and I think we could talk about, like, what are the ethics is there an ethics board in Baltimore to whom this information could have been given that would have resulted in a reprimand and a public airing if what we wanted was to clean up this process? Again, if he had the quid pro quo, then by all means, you've got to bring the case, because you're basically saying that a public official is selling the city to developers for Toys R Us, which would be really distressing to me. I'm saying if you're not able to prove that, and you know you're not able to prove that, not after months, as Patrick Fitzgerald has, but after years, I think you have to make a decision about whether some of these prosecutions are more corrosive of something that we really need, which is for the public to believe in the criminal justice system, believe that it can be fair, and for it to be fair. And I'm just not sure that I don't have all of the information, but I do think it's perfectly valid, without suggesting that this is a racial prosecution or even a political witch hunt. I think it's perfectly valid to ask that set of questions, and to ask the prosecutor, after this matter has been decided by the jury one way or another, to come forward with a full airing and discussion of the decision that went into bringing this case.
I certainly agree that there should never be a conviction in this case or any other unless the evidence that's presented is very strong and that meets that burden of proof. Anything that sort of halfway would do a great deal of damage to undermine the system. And that's why my students and I have tried to be in the courtroom to see just how strong the prosecution's case is.
I think the other question is, I'm sure this happens to Mark, I'm sure, and I know it happens to me. Whether I'm in a restaurant, whether I'm in a grocery store, or anywhere out in the public, there is, we've been talking about the corrosive effect on prosecutors and on the public's confidence in justice. But I think there is a bigger question about how much the public is growing so weary about stories of corruption from people that they elect into public office. I think even when I talk to people in the city, they're torn. I think they think that this whole gift card, the mayor's defense and explanations do not pass a smell test. But they also believe that, you know what, this mayor's doing a pretty good job. I've watched her in the public. She connects with the public. So I think that beyond whether or not the prosecution is raising bigger questions and corroding public confidence, I think there is a corrosion that really is taking place among people and what they believe and what they expect of their public servants. I think this relationship between developers, see, that's where the next leap is, regardless of the acquittal or the conviction. Yeah. How much will change at City Hall? I'm sure Sheila Dixon will not be accepting envelopes of gift cards, but how much will change about the influence that is so clear that developers have so much influence about what happens in this city?
If this case does not begin to include that discussion, it won't change. Nothing will change.
Right. Whether she's convicted or acquitted.
Whether she's convicted or acquitted. If this doesn't result in a discussion of or another trial that looks into the quid pro quo issue, that looks into the relation between developers and our politicians, then nothing changes. Then we've either convicted or not convicted a mayor for taking some gift cards, which to me, while theft is theft and has to be dealt with, if it's in fact true, what is it? What does it take? What is it? Where has this trial taken us?
Yeah,
and, right, that's why once the decision came out to not put Lipscomb on, you know, to me that actually took the wind out of it quite a bit. Because, and I understand the calculation because, you know, the idea of the boyfriend who's now the ex-boyfriend who's now, you know, turning over on the mayor and giving this evidence, and they thought they couldn't overcome kind of the character issues, but at least I thought that was going to begin to go to the implications and even some of the discussion about what votes were coming up or what, you know, something that was going to, because to me, if it's not about advancing the state of this city, you know, I think, yes, as a matter of pure criminal law, you know, it's theft and it should be prosecuted. But, you know, I think we're talking about something larger than that tonight. And I think the people of Baltimore have the right to expect something more than that.
I think,
and so if we're not, and maybe this trial can't advance it, but we've got to have that conversation.
410-319-8888. We'll take your calls in just a minute, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com as we explore the intricacies of this trial with Mayor Sheila Dixon. And Cheryl, you're about to say something?
Yeah, I think it's even larger than the relationship with developers. It'll be the relationship with special interest groups, period. I mean, it's not only developers. I mean, we know that these types of things go on, and and that discussion should happen. I think the mayor here had to divorce herself in this trial from being concerned with the court of public opinion, which is difficult for a politician to do. But she really, her defense had to center around convincing at least one of these 12 jurors that there's reasonable doubt here. And so even though the defense, as you've said, Anthony, doesn't pass a smell test with some of us in the public, some of that information is not in the trial record for them to consider, like the fact that the mayor said her relationship was over, for example, with Lipscomb back in 04, but yet the defense is that this, you know, they thought nearly 2 years later that these gift cards were an anonymous gift from him. But her relationship with him is not in the record or how long it lasted. And so the jury can only consider what's there. And so the defense figures what once she is acquitted, she can deal with the court of public opinion. But right now, she's just trying to get some reasonable doubt.
And I think it's so important what everyone's saying, that this trial should just be the first step to really learning what the relationships are between those who have wealth and power and those are who are elected to office. I don't think, though, that Mr. Lipscomb would have done anything more than Mr. Turner's direct testimony. He would have gone through the card thing, and frankly, he would have been a sideshow. He would have been cross-examined by the defense relentlessly in terms of his character. He would not have come out with the information that I think Sherilyn and I, frankly, would be very interested in hearing, but it's not going to happen at this trial. It should happen at the second trial.
410-319-8888 is the number here. James, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, James.
Very interesting what you just said, and if there's a second trial, I do believe they'll bring up Ron Lipscomb. However, the lady just stated that she believed the case was deflated when they didn't use him. They probably would have did damage on this particular case using him because he would have been a sideshow. However, what made it look kind of bad was he promised the jury that the DA promised the jury that they would bring him in. That kind of made it kind of iffy. However, they did have other evidence, if people keep forgetting that. Now, my question that I'm asking myself over and over is, this lady's making six figures. Even if you did get the cars mixed up, when were your intentions to turn those cars into the needy? See, that's the problem that I'm having with it. You know,
well,
when
I think that, and that's the problem maybe the jury's having, which is why I think the questions the jury's asking for at this moment are about Holly Trolley, which are the tickets that unquestionably were meant for poor families because of what Holly Trolley is, and they ended up in a Victoria's Secret bag inside of the mayor's house. That I think that's why these questions are being
But I think there is no question. I think this came out in the trial as well, and correct me if I'm wrong, Cheryl, because I know you've been there. They know that cards did go to the needy. Even the Ron Lipscomb cards, the Patrick Turner cards, there are percentages of those cards mm-hmm. which were obviously given out to the needy. So the argument that, you know, she pocketed, there's a perception. She pocketed all these cards and she used them for her personal gain. Yeah, there's clearly over 60 cards that were used over the course of several years by the mayor. But there's also, the fact is, she gave out many of these cards to the public. And I think the numbers bear that out. So I think this jury is wrestling with this intent. What was her intent? She obviously gave some cards out to the poor. She obviously kept some for her own personal use.
Well, I think you're correct, Anthony, with regards to the Holly Trolley cards. She did give out, and others gave out cards during that tour. The Patrick Turner cards, though, in their entirety, it seems to me, were dropped off at the mayor's office, and then she used those entirely.
Okay.
There wasn't any. So the question becomes, at least in my mind, if you believe Patrick Turner's testimony, And, you know, I hate to even go there, but, you know, when the call was made, if it was made, if his testimony is true and she did ask him either in person, he couldn't remember, or on the phone to get the cards and told her what store to get them from, was she intending to give those to the needy as she told him? He wouldn't even say needy. He said children. They were for children. He wouldn't even say the needy part. So was she intending to give them, or was she always intending to keep them? I don't know.
And that's question, though, what her intent was when, and I guess the jury, thank goodness the jury has to weigh all this, what her intent was when she asked for, and there's no question she asked for them, Patrick Turner admitted that, when she received those cards.
There's no question if you believe his testimony.
If you believe his testimony, I see what you mean. He's lying. If we're being honest, you'd have to say he is lying about why she asked for those cards.
I think there'll be a bigger public fight post conviction or
I think you're right.
Well, that's the whole thing. You see, I think what people may be underestimating is that when the verdict comes back, whatever it is, I expect there's going to be some reaction. Now, it could be a huge reaction. It could be a moderate reaction, but I'm not sure that we're prepared for what that reaction's going to be. And so I would just say that, you know, if the jury comes back tomorrow, my hope is, you know, that the verdict, at least at this stage, will be accepted, whatever it is, and that if there's an appeal, there'll be an appeal. If there's an acquittal, it'll be accepted as an acquittal. But this is what our system is, and frankly, I find myself being more of a defender of the way that we reach decisions. It's a process. It takes a long time. There's arguing. But, you know, how many of us argue about the most important things in our lives? We always like to argue. That's healthy. That's good. It's when argument turns to attack that it's not good.
And we have to take a break here, but I think that the danger is the attack that could happen inside and between communities once this decision is made that we're going to have to wrestle with and deal with. And that's the part that I worry about, listening to the, reading some of the blogs, listening to some of the other talk shows, and seeing the kind of the vehemence mm-hmm. and the kinds of words being used to describe this. This is that divide that we see in America that could come to the fore after this court makes its decision, whichever way it makes its decision. Cheryl Lightfoot, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure to have you on the air. Cheryl, what is a pleasure to meet you. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very
much.
Don't
be a stranger.
It was
come back.
Great. Absolutely.
Doug Holbert, your words are always welcome here. Great to have you on the air.
Thank you.
Anthony McCarthy and I will be back in just a minute. We're going to take your calls and thoughts when we return from this brief break. So stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We'll be right back.